you know, new kid enters the scene, you know, with a famous last name or access to money, and there's kind of these vultures that surround the person.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Wednesday, April 3rd. Today, I'm joined by Teddy Schleifer to talk about a new rich kid on the block in the world of politics and philanthropy, Rory Gates, the son of Bill and Melinda Gates, who has been quietly taking meetings in Democratic politics and taking advice from big names like Hillary Clinton and Alex Soros. He's been keeping a low profile, but Teddy has new details on whether the younger Gates will be a big player in the donor world. Teddy also has some stories from inside the courtroom where Sam Bankman-Fried, a fallen rich kid, was sentenced last week to 25 years in federal prison. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of Powers That Be.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. Welcome to the Powers That Be. I'm joined today by Teddy Schleifer to talk about two very wealthy young men. One formerly, that would be Sam Bankman-Fried, who was sentenced to federal prison last week. Teddy Schleifer was there for that. We'll talk about it more later in the episode. The other person we're going to talk about is somebody you might not have heard of. His name is Rory Gates. You might have heard of his parents, of course, Bill and Melinda Gates. But Rory, apparently Teddy, is stepping out on his own, wallet fat, into the world of politics and philanthropy. Is this a new thing? Who is this guy? I hadn't really heard of him until we got on the podcast here.
Sure. And one of the funny things about being the heir to a massive fortune is is people kind of don't really write about you until you're stepping out on your own. Partially that's because for the first 18 years of their life, people don't want to write about kids. But I've always been of the belief that these people are very important. They're going to inherit, as a class, you know, enormous amounts of money as sort of these baby boomers begin to peter out. You know, I think over the next 20 years, you're going to start seeing all these people become bigger, bigger deals. And it's not as if Rory Gates is going to inherit the entire Gates fortune, but he is going to have money. He's going to be a player. And that's kind of why people take the meeting, even though when they Google him, they don't see anything about him online. There's barely been any mention of Rory Gates on the internet, even figuring out like when he's born or where he went to college. You know, there's no LinkedIn, private Instagram, unlike his sisters who are very, very public.
Unlike most 25-year-olds.
Right, sure. Rory has become a subject of utter fascination for Democrats over the last 18 months. You know, a question I like to ask people in meetings is, who is new right now? You know, it feels like the donor class that is active in 2024, almost to a person, is some subset of the people who were active in 2020. As in, there are very few new people. There are some people who were old, who were no longer involved, and there are people who were involved in 2020 who are involved again in 2024. But finding someone who is involved this year that hasn't been involved in previous anti-Trump efforts is hard. The one exception is this 25-year-old scion of Microsoft who has become a subject of fascination for every Democrat and is the subject of our story this week at Puck.
So how much money does he theoretically have to distribute? And what exactly is this young, wealthy comer looking at giving money to? You talk about how he's being, quote unquote, mentored by Ron Conway from Silicon Valley. Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. has taken him under her wing, according to your piece. Alex Soros, mm-hmm. Who's another sort of young next gen donor. What is he bringing to the table here?
The amount of money he's bringing to the table is unclear, and that's kind of an issue for Democrats who are trying to answer that same question, right? This is someone who his parents are still alive. You know, his parents are also divorced, and there was, you know, lots of financial questions regarding the split of assets there. But people are interested in him because of the potential in the future. And I argue in this story that there's a little bit of like an illusion that's presented that basically, he doesn't actually have that much access to cash right now, but there's this expectation that there's going to be future money, which is sort of an illusion because right now, you know, my understanding is he is not somebody who's giving out, you know, 8 figures a cycle. He's giving out something like 7 figures, and you know, contributions are 6 figures a pop. So what he's bringing to the table is sort of the expectation that this is a guy who we can cultivate over the next, you know, couple of decades. And that sounds kind of creepy, but that's also how this world works. You know, there is this, you know, new kid enters the scene, you know, with a famous last name or access to money. And there's kind of these vultures that surround the person. Everyone wants to get introductions. How do I know Rory? You know, how can you introduce me to Rory? Who is Rory? You know, there's sort of a lesser obsession with Phoebe Gates, Rory's younger sister, who, you know, to be clear, is like, I don't even know if she's 22 years old. And it's weird, right? Why are all these, you know, 50-year-old Democrats obsessed with these people? But it's because they see paydays, they see influence, they see relevance. And it doesn't necessarily matter whether or not there's actual money being outlaid to Democratic or progressive groups. It's just this expectation and the perception, which is more important than the reality. And sadly, I think this also says a lot about just kind of the state of the Democratic donor community at this point, where Rory is the hottest commodity, not because he's actually giving out that much money, but because there are like few other attractive new options. He's the best dish on the menu, even if he's not really giving out $20 million checks. So it almost says something sad about kind of where Democrats find themselves in 2024, that you have a 25-year-old kid who is the obsession rather than like a real billionaire who has money to spend right now.
Listeners to the podcast can't hear me rolling my eyes at this whole thing because it reminds me a little bit of some of your reporting back in 2022 and some podcasts we did together about Sam Bankman-Fried. Rory Gates is not a criminal, obviously, but you had this sort of young Gen Z person show up on the scene in Democratic politics, in SBF's case, talking a big game and certainly talking a lot more to the media than Rory Gates. And all of these Democratic politicians and Brahmins came to kiss his ring. And he was sort of became, because of his fat wallet, somebody that the Democratic coalition and people in the media took very seriously, even though his ideas in a lot of ways were rather sophomoric, and he was obviously a huckster in hindsight. Again, not saying Rory Gates is going to turn out this way, but I guess I'm just sort of agreeing with your point that it's like, oh, I guess we got no better options. We have to deal with these rich kids and whatever they want. It just seems kind of like weird and silly in some ways to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that the money speaks for itself, right? And and there sort of is this gravitational pull to the bank accounts when these people start getting involved, where regardless of whether or not, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried or Rory Gates or Alex Soros like deserves to be in the position they are in the donor universe, like, of course it's not fair. Like, you know, it's not as if Rory Gates' opinions about the best Democratic technology matter any more than yours or mine. But like, the money talks, right? And I think the most charitable kind of version of events to the junior Mr. Gates here is that he's being very, very, very cautious. Some people feel overly cautious, right? Like, he is taking a ton of meetings, and everyone takes the meeting because, you know, it's his last name is Gates. But, you know, to hear some Democrats describe it. It's like he's like wasting all of our time, right? Like we take the meeting because, you know, we want to get $30 million in 2064, right? And he is going so slowly, and that really bothers them. That some people sort of describe Rory's interest as almost more of like an academic pursuit than like an actual donor pursuit. Like he's interested in this because he wants to be the world's expert on democratic technology, which is like, great, have at it. But like, you shouldn't necessarily have access to all these people. But the flip side of that, and then the more charitable version, is that he's not Sam Bankman-Fried. You know, Sam Bankman-Fried showed up, hired 1,000 people in, you know, 5 minutes, and, you know, dropped $100 million in 10 minutes, and then suddenly, you know, is indicted in 15 minutes later, right? And Rory is moving very slowly. You know, I think one interesting detail in this piece is even though his last name is Gates, and even though he is this, you know, subject of a fascination for Democratic donors, his day job is he's working on Capitol Hill as like a legislative, you know, analyst on the Afghanistan War Commission. He is like just kind of a regular presenting guy who is, you know, yeah, sure, he's spotted in Playbook and, you know, we're writing about him here at Puck. And, you know, he's not just another guy in Adams Morgan, but like he is interested in the actual work in a way that I think is very un-SBF-like. I'll say that much.
You mentioned his sister, Phoebe, who I think you said is younger. I just Googled her while we're talking. Yeah. She is the opposite,
very different.
Clearly.
Very different.
400,000 Instagram followers, blue check mark. You know, these two, you know, let's call them charitably Nepo babies in the donor world. She is apparently an activist for women's health and reproductive rights and getting the opportunity to write an op-ed for Vogue. You know, if her name was, you know, Phoebe Jenkins and she was from Cincinnati, Ohio, I don't think she would have access to the pages of Vogue. But as you mentioned, money talks clearly for both of them.
Yeah. One detail in my story is that Phoebe recently met with the CEO of Planned Parenthood. Can you imagine like the CEO of Planned Parenthood meeting with like a 20-year-old college student? But it's Phoebe Gates, so correct.
There you go. I'll take a quick break, Teddy. When we come back, I want to revisit your time at SBF's sentencing in New York last week.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Welcome back to The Powers That Be, everybody. We're talking lifestyles of the rich and famous Gen Z political activists. I mentioned SBF earlier, no longer rich, of course. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison last week for fraud, of course, his role of running FTX into the ground and losing investors' money. Teddy, I talked to you last week for another podcast. You were on a train up from Washington to New York to be in that room. It felt like a fitting punctuation mark for you to be there, given how much time you have spent with SBF in real life, covering him, covering his rise in politics and philanthropy, as well as his fall, obviously. Just give our listeners a sense of what it was like in that room. Were his parents there? What was the look on his face? I'm sure there was a ton of press there. Did you see him getting hauled away? I mean, I've never been in one of these things. What was it like?
Me neither. Certainly never had someone who was my age who you kind of watched rise alongside you be sentenced to 25 years in prison. So he walked in wearing, you know, a tan jumpsuit. You know, listeners will remember he's been in jail actually since last August because his bail was revoked. But, you know, during the trial, he was allowed to wear a suit to sort of present a more professional look to the jury. But there's no jury this time. You know, the way that sentencing works is you are, you know, it's a dictatorship. The judge decides. You can appeal. It's not going to go anywhere. And we had, for about 2 hours at this courthouse in Lower Manhattan, Sam Bankman-Fried and, you know, his parents and a couple other sympathetic people behind him, including people who work for him, who are, you know, lawyers on his behalf, were arguing to the judge that there were not really that many victims of this crime when all is said and done because of kind of the rise in crypto prices that basically all customers are going to be made whole, which is sort of true. And they argued that this is a brilliant guy whose life should not be sentenced to 40 years in jail and 40 years of infamy, which is what the government wanted. They were arguing that this guy should be sentenced to 5 years or 6 years of prison time. To hear prosecutors describe it, this guy perpetrated the, you know, most sophisticated financial fraud since Bernie Madoff, and that the U.S. government should be sending a loud and clear message that this is not okay, that this is not a crime that is, you know, a ticky-tack foul, but this is, you know, a double technical, and this is someone who should be, you know, sentenced for five decades of his life. So it's 25 years. It was obviously going to be between those two numbers. And, you know, the scene, it was sad. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, you know, regardless of whether or not he deserves it, it's a sad day. His parents were behind him and they were heartbroken. They marched out into the rain in New York that Thursday afternoon. And, you know, we'll probably not see them again for a while. This is sort of the end of the road here. It's the end of the trial. The most fascinating moment of the whole thing was Sam's decision to speak. So for about 20 minutes as part of this two-hour hearing, Sam was given the floor to say whatever he wanted, right? And his hearing his explanation of everything that happened, you know, at that point, he's not arguing that he didn't commit the crime because he's been convicted of the crime, but he's trying to offer his version of events that is the most sympathetic, that means he shouldn't get 50 years. And hearing that speech, I thought, was the moment that it really settled in that we're not going to see this guy outside of a jail cell until he is 57 years old. So
what did he actually say in his remarks?
Sure. You know, he appeared genuinely sad and sympathetic when talking about his colleagues. You know, he talked about the pain he inflicted upon his brother, upon, you know, characters we now know like Carolyn Ellison and Nishad Singh. He said what happened haunts him every day. He talked about some specific people he injured, like specific victims. He clearly had like read the material. It's almost reminded me, Peter, like a politician when they meet a voter on a rope line and then like recite the story on a campaign on the dais to illustrate that you listened. Like he referenced like a letter by Marcel, a letter by Alejandro. So that was when he was at his best. I mean, as worst, he talked about the whole thing as this in like a mistakes were made sort of frame. You know, he talked about it as if, you know, he was the victim of circumstance. And the government really keyed in on that. Like they pointed out the fact in their response to his speech that he never said that he was really sorry for any of it. Mm. You know, they keyed on the fact that Sam talked about him having a big opportunity to do good, and that they sort of interpreted that comment from Sam as him saying that he had a big opportunity to like commit crimes again. you know, Sam really tried to portray himself also interestingly as like as autistic and is sort of the victim of, you know, mental illness. Hmm. And the judge bought that, but he just did not think that there was enough remorse He suggested, the Judge Kaplan in his sentencing decision suggested that, I'm reading from my notes here, there is a risk that this man will be in a position to do something really bad in the future, and it's not a trivial risk. Like, there was almost this perception that this is a guy who is so driven by expected value, so driven by the math, that he could always justify another crime if the math allowed him to in the future. And that, like, that there's something pathological about him, which, you know, hearing his speech, you can kind of see how Sam would, how you would get to that impression. So at the end of the day, 300 months, which is 25 years for a truly, truly heinous crime, and one that we kind of had a front row seat to, for better or for worse.
I want to correct something I said earlier. Sam Bankman-Fried is actually a millennial, not Gen Z. Gen Z catches a lot of shit. I don't want them to be saddled with owning SPF 2. Just important to correct the record there. Teddy, thank you so much for your journeys among the young, wealthy people of our country. We appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.